have any interviews yet, or what, for radio yet, or?
Not for the campaign. Uh-huh. I mean, in my role as a children's advocate, we're often trying to work with media to get the issues out that we work on. But no, you know, it's been kind of a media-free environment. A lot of public forums.
Yeah, tons of them.
Which, I think some of them are better than others. Yeah. But it's hard for people who, you know, don't interact with the issues that much. I get a kind of a sense that they aren't really hitting in the way. Like, you get 1 minute to answer really complex questions like unfunded pension obligations. And so I think they get I think the best thing is they get a little slice of our personalities. And that's something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I went along there. They're very interesting. So hopefully this can be a chance to be more thoughtful. Would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Amy Lemley, and I'm a candidate for Oakland City Council, District 1. I live in North Oakland with my husband, Justin, and we've got two children, a daughter, Violet, who's just turned 7, and a 1-year-old. And let me say more.
That's wonderful. That's perfect. I got to say, I'm really interested in First Place for Youth. Mm-hmm. Can you say a little bit how you founded that?
Mm-hmm. I, before moving to California, lived in Boston. And after graduating from the University of Chicago, I did a very brief stint, which I still can't believe, in management consulting. You know, my parents had really put out a lot of money for this fancy school, and I thought I should do this fancy job, and was miserable there. And so after doing that briefly, I wanted to do something that I knew was the right thing to do. And that was, you know, to do serve people in some capacity. And so I convinced this group home for parenting and pregnant teens to hire me, despite the fact I truly had no qualifications. And that's where the idea for First Place came from. It was all pregnant and parenting young women in foster care. And, you know, I was just a residential group home counselor. And, you know, time after time, it was my job to pack these young women up with their children, essentially escort them off the premises, and then proceed to, you know, watch them often lose custody of their kids, often become homeless, often get drawn into the criminal justice system. And so First Place was a response to that. It was a way to say, you know, these young people are victims. They haven't done anything wrong, and they deserve a better future than that. And they deserve the same type of common sense support that most parents give most of their kids. And so that was it. And then a very dear friend of mine that I met in grad school, she was very excited about the idea of being entrepreneurial and very committed to the issue. And so we started First Place together, and it was a wonderful experience, and it continues to be a very successful organization.
I mean, that must have been an amazing challenge to start an organization from the ground up without ever having done something like that before. Was it hard?
It was very hard. I mean, it was hard for a lot of reasons. It was hard financially because we had no funding. And it was also hard because the depth of these young people's needs is vast and complex. And, you know, these are people's lives, and you're kind of purporting to have some type of solution. And they're taking you seriously. And so it's a very big responsibility. Also challenging because employees, you know, you have taken responsibility for their livelihood. This is how people pay their mortgages, pay their grocery bills, and that funding better come in. And so there's a lot of growth on a lot of different levels for me at First Place. And it really gave me a high level of respect for, one, is really being an employer, as strange as it sounds. I think it's something, it's kind of like being a landlord. People don't take it seriously enough. It's a very big responsibility. But secondly, how alone and how unsupported so many young people in Oakland are. It's hard for us to imagine not having even one parent that's able to do anything for you. When you're 18 years old and you're the most together person in your family, dad is missing, mom is in the throes of chemical dependency, you're out there in an expensive, harsh, dangerous environment, you're doing your best to make the best decisions every day, and you just can't get ahead. And seeing that, and seeing young people who are trying so hard, was sad at times, but also seeing that when someone meets them halfway, what they're able to parlay that into was really, really inspirational. And, you know, has lit a fire in me, that is motivating me to kind of move on and keep trying to, make a difference.
Yeah. So speaking of what you're trying to move on to, I wonder, I was thinking of questions to ask you, and I wonder if your desire to run is motivated by, you see the city council and you're like, what they're doing is great. Like, you know, Jane Bruner stepping aside, I want to do exactly what she did and be that model. Or is it motivated by they could be doing better, and I see ways in which I could improve on how the city council conducts business?
I am motivated by a desire to change the city council's approach. I think we have wonderful people in city council, and they're very well-intentioned, and they've been working on behalf of the city for many years. And so I think it's important not to tear people down, because each one of them should be proud of different accomplishments they've had. However, the city as a whole, I feel like there is so much that is not seen and that no one is taking action on. And specifically, we have a 14.4% rate of unemployment. And that's over 30,000 Oakland residents who are not employed, who don't have the money. Their unemployment benefits may or may not have run out. They don't have the money to pay their mortgage and to live their basic lives and to care for their children. And that unemployment parlays into a 28% rate of child poverty. And so, you know, for me, these are the preconditions to a healthy community and to a safe community. And so that is extremely important to me, to change those factors, to change them for the lives of those individuals. But also, if we can address those issues, we can improve the quality of life for all Oakland residents. So I want to be a council member that can bridge this world, can bridge a world from where I live in a very lovely part of Rockridge to a world in Oakland that desperately needs needs more economic development, needs more parents with a living wage job so they can care for their children and be economically successful. And I don't think that has been a major emphasis of the District 1 council member. I don't think we've made the case of how we need to bring more of those families out of poverty and into kind of economic stability, and how economic development is a really essential part of that.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'm interested. I read your issues, and I read about making the council cooperate more and doing more to encourage business development. But I'm interested in, I guess, you know, maybe if you want to feel like fleshing out some of those ideas for bringing business to Oakland.
Well, we, you know, are, you know, 11, 13 miles away from San Francisco, and yet we really don't benefit from a very much of a spillover effect. I feel that when we talk about economic development, we are pretty good about talking about the effect that these different types of commercial developments may have on neighborhoods. And that's a lot of the times where the story starts and where the story ends. How can we also expand the conversation to understand how many jobs come from this type of economic development, how much business license tax, and how much sales tax? So we get a full picture of the potential pros and cons. I think to move in this direction, we need to move out of a posture that the current council is in, I believe, that pits the public sector against the private sector. And I think we need to move out of that posture. I don't think it's constructive, and I don't think it is moving families out of poverty and bringing more revenue to the city. I want to be a council member that is able to work constructively and respectfully and responsibly with the private sector, understand what they need from the city, and see more projects not just get started, but actually go to completion. And so there are a lot of different things we can do. One specific thing is I'd like to really change our planning process. I believe our planning process, one, is that pits residents against the project sponsor and is overly adversarial. And I think for a model of how we can change, we only need to look to Berkeley. Under Mayor Tom Bates, Tom Bates has really, I believe, changed Berkeley's approach to planning and has created a process where there are very clear timelines that are agreed to by residents, project sponsors, and the planning department, and the elected official from the area, and where the project sponsor and the community is working together from day one. In Oakland, we often if we're doing a big area plan, we have a lot of conversations about what we would like it to be before we bring in an actual project sponsor or a developer. And in some ways, we maybe inflate the expectations about what's possible versus really from day one working with the project developer who's going to put in the time and put in the money and begin to understand what is possible for that particular parcel or that particular development. I think that is going to increase the odds that we get good projects where the community has real input and that actually go across the finish line and translate into the jobs and the revenue we want. I often kind of think of our planning in Oakland as kind of like a box of See's candy. And we, you know, take a bite out of one and we don't finish it. We take a bite out of another. And the best example of that is our Oak to Ninth development, which, you know, thousands of hours of time were put in by the community, by city staff, and by many others. And while we did that, the housing market totally collapsed and we have nothing today. So I think we have a little bit of a case of letting the best be the enemy of the good. I think we're also a little bit guilty of looking at San Francisco and looking at their approach and trying to apply some of their approaches to Oakland when we have a fundamentally different economy and a different market. And so those are some thoughts I have about how we can begin to, you know, just project by project, start to move things forward and bring those jobs and bring that revenue to Oakland.
So if I'm hearing you properly, it's about kind of streamlining the process a little bit without losing any of the important EIR functions. But right. I've heard people complain about how hard it is to get a project done in Oakland. So you're kind of talking about making it easier for them without sacrificing. Is that
a good way to put it? Absolutely. Without sacrificing community input, but by making the community input real and relevant at the right time. I think a perfect example of how that's not the case is we had a planning commission that voted, you know, 5-0 for the Safeway. Well, the Safeway project at College and Claremont. Well, at the same time, we had 3.5 hours of testimony by the neighborhood, and you know, so that's a process where the two sides are not intersecting, and you know, whether you like the Safeway project or whether you don't, there should be a process where we are able to feed that input together and make sure that. That it's considered in a real way and not in a token way, which is, I think, what often can be the case. And so it makes residents mad and it makes them want to kill projects. So that's not what we need. We need to find more durable ways of working together, of staying together, of having hard conversations and having a leader who's able to balance this tension between, you know, we don't want to disturb the quality and character of our neighborhoods and we need more economic development. We are a city that needs much more revenue to do all the things we want to do, including to provide our residents a baseline level of public safety, which we totally are not doing right now.
Yeah. Actually, I just had one more question before I move to that, but about the kinds of development you'd like to see, downtown high-rises, for one, how do you feel about those?
You know, honestly, I'm agnostic. I'm not a city planner and I'm not an architect. I think part of the problem we've had in Oakland is we have had community members and city council members who have acted as though they are. We need to be receptive to a range of different developments. Some of them will be, you know, the gold standard, mixed use, transit oriented, you know, the creme de la creme. That's what I personally would like. But I also appreciate that there's a place in our economy for other types of development. I would do my best as a council member to make that case to a property owner or developer. But I'd also respect if that were not possible, I would not delay a project. So I believe we want to foster a lot of different types of approaches. And I think that when we can change the perception and the reality about how hard it is to work with Oakland, we can start to see better and better projects. But we can't start with the gold standard.
So public safety. So, I mean, we can start, you know, the issue everyone talks about is cops and everyone's got like the number. Do you have your own number?
For me, the number is about our incidence level. And, you know, my background's public policy, and I think that we should have a level of police staffing that is equal to what other cities have in California. And so we currently have 1.3 police officers per 1,000. I'd like to bring that up to the state level average of 2.5 police officers per 1,000, which would put us at about 1,000 police officers. If our population grows, obviously we would need more. And if it shrinks, as it has slightly, we would need less. And so I think about it more of an incidence level. And I do think, you know, as we don't need a, you know, for a city that is the fourth most dangerous in the nation, I think there's a case to be made for at least having the same number of police as other similarly sized cities.
So I just was doing some math in my head. The number I've heard for cop is about 200,000 for full time. So that's a million for every five cops. You know, if we added 500 cops, maybe $100 million. How do we pay for that?
Well, I think the number per cop ranges. I've heard 176,000 per police officer. This is the first time I've heard 250,000.
Oh,
200,000. Yeah. Oh, 200,000. So there's not that much difference there.
Yeah.
It's not something that happens certainly overnight. I think where we start is we recently had an $11 million kind of bump in revenue from the city. Is we begin, you know, we commit ourselves, if public safety is a key concern, and trust me, from walking thousands of doors and talking to everyday residents, time and time again, it's raised. Is committing to dedicate that revenue to expanded police academies. Secondly, I truly believe that this emphasis on economic development and beginning to see projects through is something that can begin to bear fruit shortly. So the issue around, actually we have 650 police now. So to get to first to 800 would be my first step, and then to get to 1,000. So I think we will begin to see some revenue from that economic development if we begin to focus on it. I think the challenge is people think about these master developments like Coliseum City, which is exciting, and Broadway Valdez, that's great. But there are projects today that are dying on the vine. A grocery store, 30th and Broadway. Let's get that going. Let's get it built. Let's get that money. Rebecca Kaplan is working hard to get Costco on Mandela Parkway. Jobs that are $14.50 an hour. A lot of money from sales tax and business license tax. Those aren't the fancy, exciting, plans that are going to transform a neighborhood. But, store by store, they make a difference. And I think that particularly in the era where there is no redevelopment, continuing our focus on these large plans where we don't have an identified project sponsor to come and kind of build it is not as productive as, on many, many fronts going after different kinds of development. So my strategy really is to dedicate new revenue as the economy begins to get better, focus on economic development, and focus those monies on additional police as well. But truly, hopefully after a year or two of doing this and demonstrating to the community that there is a serious city council that is working hard and taking new approaches to getting revenue, that we could potentially turn back to the voters for some type of revenue measure. I'm not naive. I know how much money that is. But I also know that the last two parcel taxes in Oakland have been rejected. And there was recently a poll done again that showed the level of support was at 38%. So to me, we have to show the electorate that they are not ATMs. We also have to show the unions that we've appreciated the sacrifices they've made. For the last 4 years, all of our unions have given back concessions, more contributions to retirement, furlough days, you name it, wage reductions. And so from my point of view, we're kind of at the end of that rope too. So the pragmatist in me said, this is the one strategy we really have not tried truly. So let's give it everything we've got. Let's demonstrate a level of capacity and competence to the electorate. And maybe we can get a third or maybe even half the way there and then turn back to the voters after we've restored some of the public confidence and propose some type of revenue generating measure. such as a parcel tax, or it could be a revision of the real estate transfer tax to make it more progressive, to structure it similarly to San Francisco.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. That makes a lot of sense. To talk a little bit more about public workers and maybe cops and their pay, I understand that Oakland police are some of the highest paid in the state. Is there any room for talking about paying them less and compensating them less?
I don't think at this time. I know that that's become a big part of the conversation. I think it's important to talk, you know, very specifically about the wages of these individuals and what we ask of them. And it's, you know, these are not people earning $200,000, $250,000 a year. You know, our police are well paid, and they put their lives on the line every day. I earn a lot more than them, and a lot of people do. So you really need to ask yourself, would I, for probably about $70,000 a year, certainly as a starting one, go out there with a gun and, you know, try and put myself in these situations? And so my feeling about that is we need to be very smart and careful and respectful in our conversations about this, because we don't want to go into bankruptcy. And a recent League of Cities report kind of concluded, all right, what makes a city likely to go into bankruptcy? One is it old? Check. Yes, Oakland's old. Is it? Does it have aging infrastructure? Yes. And the third factor was, does the city have an adversarial relationship with its organized labor? Right now, we don't. The only thing that has kept our budget balanced is this relationship with labor, where conversations happen and concessions are made voluntarily. I think it's extremely dangerous and irresponsible to kind of run up against the police union or other unions, and to get caught up in what I believe is a right-wing propaganda in the mainstream media. And we need to confront this culture of austerity and confront these false trade-offs that say we need to undermine our commitment to labor in order to keep our city solvent. I'm very discouraged to see that message coming out in the conversation about the election, because I don't think it's specific, and I don't think ultimately it will be productive.
Are you talking about the local election?
Yeah. You know, I think it's mirroring a larger conversation that's happening around the European Union, that's happening in the federal government. We're in a very different situation here. One, we're in a different situation because of our values and our belief and supporting working families. But we're also in a different situation in that if we declare bankruptcy, we do not get released from any of our pension obligations. So people running around throwing out firebombs like that should be very mindful of that. We will still have to maintain our pension obligations. We will just have to borrow money at rates that are triple of what we currently borrow it at for our cash flow purposes. So I know it's a big challenge to get the number of police staffing that we have. I think if we make a good faith effort as a council to focus on economic and to bring new revenue in, the unions are seeing that as well. Right now, I don't think labor and our organized workers are seeing city council accomplish very much. And so after 4 years of givebacks, having us turn to them again, what have you done for me lately? What have you done, city council, to solve this problem? And from my vantage point, it's not much. It's ask for another parcel tax and ask for more labor concessions. And where is the political courage to stand up and say, Oakland is in the middle of one of the most dynamic commercial corridors in the nation. Our land isn't any different. Our people aren't any different. There is no justifiable reason why we cannot have more revenue in this city, and have city leaders who are actually willing to go out and pursue that versus turn to the usual sources of revenue. So I think if we do that, it will demonstrate something to the electorate, to our residents, but it'll also, if we did, in fact, have to turn back to our employees, at least they could say, you know what, the people representing us, the people that we sit around the bargaining table with, they did it their best and they gave it their best try, and I can respect that. And I don't think that's necessarily something that could be said today.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I hear what you're saying about not asking for more concessions when they've already given up a lot. But I wonder if there's any room for getting pay in line with other cities. I know Oakland's the most dangerous city in California, but you know, it's not as though people won't do the job for less. You know, the recent lines around the block for the police academy show. Right. This is a job people want. So am I hearing you say more that it's sort of a political issue? You don't want to make the unions mad, or is it more of a fairness thing? They should be paid above what any other cop is paid because it's more dangerous.
I really think it's both. I mean, there's a pragmatist in me where, you know, it's like, I don't think kind of running at the police department and calling for this, I think it's, would seriously damage our labor relations with the city. I think it could lead us down a path to bankruptcy. Secondly, I think there's also a very fair case to be made that their jobs are very challenging. They go on twice as many calls, sometimes three times as many calls per shift. They may be paid more than Moraga or Pleasanton or Orinda, but the job they have is fundamentally different. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's, just from a basic fairness and equity point of view, there's a case to be made. But honestly, the political case is equally compelling to me. I don't see OPOA is not going to just lay down and take a major wage cut, as they shouldn't. And I think it jeopardizes our relationships and our capacity to keep working together to keep the city economically solvent. And so both of those say to me that isn't an approach that I would take, certainly, until I saw the city council do its best to at least try and solve the problem in a way that it hasn't.
So I have to ask, you know, a tough question now. You're endorsed by the police, and fire and labor. And if you were a city council person, you'd be negotiating with them. Mm-hmm. How do those two things sort of sort out? The fact that someone who supported you then is on the other side of the bargaining table from you, mm-hmm. and you have to be representing the city, not representing them.
You know, it's very interesting you ask that because, you know, I am not, this is my first time being a candidate. It's my first time filling out all these questionnaires and first time going in front of these panels and first time having to do any type of political fundraising. And so it's been an incredible education for me. Like, what is the role of money in politics? You know, I certainly thought, you know, wow, this is going to be interesting. There's going to be all these special interests who line up and offer me these big checks. Quite the opposite. I mean, it is a... to get out and send your message to 40,000 voters, which is how many we have in District 1, is a real challenge. And all of the support of the 330 donations I've received, all but three are from just plain old people. And so I kind of take a little bit of exception to the idea that three checks that aren't that much bigger than the rest of my 300 and some would completely undermine a value system that I was raised with, that I have lived professionally my entire life, dedicated my entire professional life to addressing the needs of homeless, abused, and neglected children. So it's been interesting. I have had a hard time squaring myself with that because I feel like it is extremely dismissive or doesn't appreciate what I have done to try and bring children and families out of poverty, trying to engage them in economic stability. So I think that's one thing to note. If people think that these unions are writing like $10,000 checks, they're not. The maximum individual contribution is $700, and a political union can write a $1,300 check. And we have very strict campaign contribution limit laws in Oakland. So that's one thing. It's not as though half of mine or really half of any candidate's contributions are coming from these entities. You know, as for what it's going to mean to sit around the bargaining table, I just as the other endorsements that I've gotten from elected officials, they've endorsed me because they respect who I am and how I make decisions. And that goes the same for the labor endorsements I've gotten. I have been clear and independent in my responses to their answers. They know where I sit And the answers I give to you today are the reasons why they've endorsed me. They're not because they've endorsed me. Mm-hmm. They understand that, I mean, I work for John Burton. You know, I am a person who believes that labor unions have played a really important role in the quality of working families' lives for many, many decades. As my husband always say, you like the weekend? Thank a union. You like minimum wage? You know, all of these labor practices that are now part of our economy began with organized labor. And so I think for me, they saw me as a candidate who truly respects that relationship and kind of shares their values and does not want to see what I believe is happening as a race to the bottom. Then I think the idea is if all private sector workers such as myself, you know, I don't have a pension and my employer doesn't even contribute to my 401k, but it doesn't mean I want to take away from one of our six city employees who paints light poles and probably earns $55,000 a year. Again, I think the problem with a lot of these wage and pension issues is exceptional cases, people in senior level management who really get a golden parachute. And, you know, and that chaps me and it chaps a lot of people. And when those cases come out, it really rubs people the wrong way. And we really need to prevent those type of cases from happening. But it's important to be specific and to understand that that is not most workers. Most workers are earning $55,000, $60,000 a year. When they retire after 25 or 30 years of service, their pension will be about $25,000 or $30,000 a year. You know, these workers are not laughing their way to the bank. That is, again, part of what I believe is a right-wing, I don't hate to say the word conspiracy, but it's a strategy to dismantle one of the structures in our economy and our culture that has actually sustained the middle class.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a very complicated issue because I personally come from a liberal background, and I've gone through a little bit of a transformation, especially when I came to understand the role of the stock market in supporting these, and the way that pensions were sort of expanded in good times and never rolled back in bad times. And the situation it seems now is a little bit tricky in Oakland. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, over $2.5 billion pick your number, for the discount rate, in pension and healthcare costs. So, I mean, is that a problem? Is that something we can grow our way out of? Is that, do you hope the stock market gets 10% returns every year? Like how do you approach that?
One is I think you hit on something really important, which is the role of the stock market and the role of speculative investors in crashing our whole system in terms of, you know, for many years we did have a rate of return on CalPERS that was very healthy. And so, you know, the problem didn't start with labor and it shouldn't end with labor. I mean, people were fine during the boom years when these speculative investments were making everyone rich and pumping up the price of housing. But now that we've seen what was actually going on, and you know, millions and billions of dollars were lost, and now our pension funds have suffered mightily. To kind of, no one on Wall Street was held accountable for that. No one went to jail for that. But we need to screw our city employees. I mean, I take real exception with that. If we had real accountability on the national level, and we had seen the people who orchestrated these type of trading and put together these speculative investment products held accountable, and if we had real reform on the federal level so that this will not happen again, I would say let's share the pain. But from my point of view, the people who are on the receiving end of the pain now are people who didn't do anything wrong. They didn't put together these crazy products and tranche after tranche and put them all together and sell them as like as good assets when in fact they were total junk assets. And so, you know, that is something that I think has to be part of the conversation in a way that is currently not. Mm-hmm. As for the real practical reality in terms of what we do, I'd like to start with a very detailed understanding of how much we owe and when we owe it. That is something, you know, even Daniel Bornstein can really not tell us. That information is not easily accessible. It's not transparent. Because to me, when we owe it is as important as what we owe. I own a home, I have a mortgage. The debt that I pay towards my home is a problem if it's due and I don't have money, or it's due before payday. And so what is our projected revenue stream? What is our schedule of debt payments? I know it's $2.5 billion. I don't think that there's a scenario in the past or in the future where cities don't have some debt. But I do think it's important to know when we need to pay it so that we can be mindful and actually have a fuller conversation. And we can have that conversation as part of the budget development process. Our massive unfunded pension obligations and just general debt does not seem to intersect with our budget conversation. And that is silly, because obviously the money to begin to pay that is going to have to come from our budget. And we have to be clear about how we balance our priorities between things such as public safety and when our pension obligation bonds run out and we have a, you know, $35, $40 million bill come due. Again, I think this, we go back to the city council. There's something that is preventing long-term planning. And if we don't change that, we're not going to move ahead. A really good example of that is Measure Y. So Measure Y needs to be reauthorized in 2014. It is not supported by the electorate, in my opinion. It's something I hear complained about regularly because we did not deliver our minimum force level or our number of community policing officers. So, and if it is not reauthorized, we create a $20 million hole in our budget. Now, the nonprofits that get contracts, frankly, can just be discontinued. That would be very tragic. I think it would be a real move backward, but that at least can be handled. All of the police and fire, however, that are paid for it, that solution is not so simple. So this is just one example of our lack of advance planning. And so how we work with the administration and the city administrator to begin to work much more in advance. And I think we can do that by introducing a minimum meeting ordinance. In the very recent history, I think as soon as 5 years ago, the council used to meet every week. And much more business was conducted at that time. Then it voted to move its meetings to every other week. Now, what that has resulted in is very long meetings that go late into the night. The public has less access to them. And we're also not doing the business we need to be doing. A good example of that is the pension obligation bonds. Conversation about those pension obligation bonds, or the public conversation about that at the city council meeting, I believe started at like 1:15 in the morning. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is, we have to be meeting more. We have to be working more. If we're going to do the kind of planning and work together with the administration that needs to be done. We are not a caretaker council. We are not Moraga City Council. We need to have a commitment from all council members that this is the only position that they will hold, and that they just won't work full time. They'll work double time and be committed to either restoring council meetings to every Tuesday or at least having a minimum meeting ordinance. Because when we made that change, we did not reduce the length of the recess. So we have the exact same length of recesses, but we have fewer meetings. And to anyone who says, well, meetings isn't where work really gets done, for a legislative body, it's the only place work gets done. And so because you can only a certain number of people can meet together without violating the Brown Act. So if you want to have a full conversation of the council, you actually do need to have a public forum, and that's a city council meeting. Yeah. So getting better financial planning, understanding when these debts are due, understanding how much of our budget is going to need to be dedicated to them to keep the lights on and to keep the bureaucracy moving forward. And we don't have those answers. And so before we have those answers, I think we shouldn't kind of pursue what I think could be very damaging approaches. Now, when we get those answers, and if for some reason we see, oh my gosh, you know, pretty much, it's rolling downhill within 5 years, then that's information that can be shared with unions. It can be information that's shared with the electorate, and we can make good decisions based on it. But right now, I don't believe that information is information we have. My question is, why don't we? I mean, our massive debt problem isn't something that just came up with this election cycle. I'm not a city council member. And so I don't know how hard it is to get these kind of reports and this kind of information from the administration, but I am a kind of person that really wants to work collaboratively with the administration to understand the situation a lot better, because we should be making our decisions with that evidence and not just on what I believe decisions are currently made with, which is power and politics and posturing. And I don't think that when decisions are made with that instead of with evidence, we're going to get as good of outcome, certainly.
You're good at this.
Oh, well, thanks.
So just to make sure I understand, so you think, you know, there is a problem. It's a real problem.
Absolutely.
But we can look at it squarely and we can grow our way out of it. And it's not something that requires drastic measures.
I think it may require drastic measures. I think at this juncture, $2.5 billion is the goal to eliminate that tomorrow. If it is, we've got some seriously drastic measures. $2.5 billion, I mean, is it to eliminate that over 7 years? Well, then we have a different issue. All right, $2.5 billion is our goal to wean that down over the 25 years it took to build it up. Then we have a different proposal. We have to know what the strategy is before we develop the solution. And to say that, you know, absolutely to eliminate that tomorrow, we'd basically have to almost get rid of the whole city government and have a huge parcel tax. And that wouldn't be acceptable for anybody. But if we develop a potentially 10 to 15 year plan, where we have very conservative estimates on the level of growth, I'm not arguing for, Pollyannish estimates. We're going to turn into San Francisco. No, we're not. You know, our best case scenario is continuous modest growth, and then potentially factoring in some type of revenue generating measure in maybe 2 to 4 years, and really looking to see what those add up to, and how much of those could be basically dedicated towards managing down this debt, and then also reaching a consensus what level of ongoing debt is tolerable. The goal doesn't need to be zero debt. I don't have zero debt, and I bet you don't have zero debt either. Very few people do, and almost no governments do. Mm. It's a level of debt that we feel good about. Right now, too much of our general fund is going to debt service. That is a huge problem. Instead of paying for police and parks and senior centers and repairing our terrible roads, we are servicing debt. And so I don't think anyone would agree that the level of debt service we have now is acceptable. It's not. But what level is, and working to manage it down to that. And so I think that's the approach that I take. But again, I don't think there's any consensus about how long we want to get to that level and what that level is. And I think we've got a lot of people, certainly in the political environment, who are running around throwing, you know, these fire bombs out and as though the end is nigh. We have an extremely serious problem. And it's one that I'm very committed to taking on, but in an analytical way, and in a collaborative way, and in a specific way that really engages the residents. And in this way, I really like Jerry Brown's approach. It's like, well, what kind of Oakland do you want? Do you want an Oakland with senior centers? Do you want an Oakland that does any social services? Maybe not. Do you want an Oakland that has more public safety? Really having a conversation with residents in a way that we're not having that same conversation with the unions. And then, you know, coming together with the administration on this strategy. So it's, you know, it's not the sexy magic wand. We'll make it all go away with one parcel tax. Again, it's the same thing with young people. When I met a young person, these are the throes of chemical dependency, homeless, prostituting. Like, they got here because of a lifetime of neglect. You know, they weren't cared for by their parents. They didn't receive the support they needed as an adolescent. The system turned them out when they were a young adult, and then they were exploited by people as they aged. And taking a young person like that and bringing them and making them whole and caring for them and and bringing them back to life in some ways, you know, and this is a lot of people who worked for me. They were so frustrated and they would get so mad and so angry. And it's just like, we have to have patience and we have to be willing to work with this young person and have a little faith in them. And I think the analogy stands for Oakland. You know, the solution is not right around the corner. But we have to believe there's something good about Oakland, something we can draw on to solve this problem. Or else people might as well just move away. You know, and I don't think that that's a solution. Unfortunately, it's one that more and more residents are turning to. And something that is not coming out in the campaign to the extent that I think it should be is we've lost 15% of our children between 2000 and 2010. And in my opinion, a city that is losing children is a dying city, because that means families are leaving. And families are the people who are working, who are spending, who are volunteering. We desperately need families, and we need to offer families a better combination of services than they're currently getting, which is, you know, marginal schools, high crime, and high cost housing. I mean, that's kind of like the death trifecta of a family. And it's not just because I am a mother and I have a family here. It's a lot of people that I talk to and that my kids go to school with saying, you know, we want to be in Oakland and we love Oakland, and we don't feel like the city is meeting us halfway.
Yeah. Did you compare Oakland to a young person with a chemical dependency?
How sad.
No, that's a great analogy, though. I think it's something.
Well, you know, but what's important is, you know, I maybe that comparison seems dark, but when you really love young people and you really see the strength and the goodness in them. You know, to me, I've worked with so many young people with so many different kinds of challenges. But to say that our city is not healthy and not whole, I don't think that that's unfair. I feel, you know, so fortunate, truly fortunate, that my family is not suffering economically in the way that so many other families are. But when we look at the city as a whole and we look at pockets here and there, you know, we're far from beginning to address the needs that they have. And we're abandoning them. So I guess I did make that analogy. That one might sink me.